treatment operators on those reserves.
Wow. And 15 years of like in like indulging in this topic, I am so curious, like were the communities really welcoming to you and
Oh, they were pleading with us, and more than welcoming. My regret is that we couldn't have helped more of them, and we would have been able to if INAC had even a little bit of political will to do so. But one example is that my husband back then, his name was Hans, Dr. Peterson. He was a research scientist. He developed a system where we could have dropped in a system to every single First Nations in Canada and given them the ability to provide absolutely safe drinking water. And that was, it met the highest, most robust standards going. Now, it would not have allowed for that water to be distributed to all the different homes, but they could have gone to the point of treatment, whether it was groundwater or source water, as a source water or surface water. They would have had access to that to then provide all, for example, baby formula, to mix all of their baby formula instead of having to fly in all the bottled waters. But INAC were completely uninterested. They just blocked it at every possible state. And one of the factors of this system was that it didn't use any chemicals. So the different communities, if they had a community of less than 3,000 people, they were probably spending $100,000 a year in chemicals, and that was no longer required. So the kickback from the chemical companies was huge.
You made reference to, baby formula, and obviously, yes, if you don't have clean drinking water and you are trying to nourish your child, obviously contamination, and what is that going to do for, your child and the community at large? How would you say that, like, not having safe drinking water has affected, like, women and obviously children in these communities?
It's huge and it's complicated because in Indigenous cultural society, the water is the female spirit. And so they worship water as they would worship a woman. And when you think about it, every baby is born in amniotic fluid and born of the woman. And women are predominantly, excuse me, disadvantaged. They're often impoverished. They're the caregivers. They have so many socioeconomic issues to deal with as well. But then the irony is that if you have unsafe drinking water, it's going to impact the children and the elderly, but the women more than anything. The women are the caregivers. They're nursing all of these people. And it just, I will never forget all the sores I saw on their bodies, the problems, because if they had heart issues or any kind of medical issues, everything was complicated that much more by having unsafe drinking water.
You were then like prompted to write a second book though. And your second book is called Water Justice. What You Don't Know Could Kill You is, what prompted you to write this book and carry on?
I had no plans at all to write a second book. I thought I was done after one. But so many readers contacted me, and I don't ever want to downplay the fact that Indigenous people have had the hardest fight for safe drinking water one could ever imagine in Canada. It's absolutely atrocious.
Absolutely.
But the readers were calling me and saying, well, have you heard about this? And what do you think about that? And at first, I just replied to them, and then they kept coming at me more and more and more. And I felt I had an obligation to write this down, and it became another book accidentally because, while this is mostly an Indigenous issue, what many Canadians don't realize yet is that they are actually no better off than many of the First Nations, and in some cases worse. We have the most atrocious neglect of our water, both source waters and treated water, of any developed country.
Wow. And this is why having conversations like this is so important, because I feel like, many Canadians don't know this, right? I think that we, go through life thinking completely opposite of what you just shared with me,
Absolutely.
right? After writing two books and, with all the work that you've done over the years, have there been any positive changes, especially after the second book, that you were able to discover?
I hope I can answer that with a yes at the end of October after we have our municipal elections,
Okay.
because there are a number of candidates running against the old crones that are absolutely all about profit over people and have no respect for the environment, have no respect for people's health. And it's time they got replaced. We've got mayors and council members who I call it willful ignorance because they're not interested in learning. But we have people starting to put their names in the hat that are genuinely wanting to create a better place in whichever community they're running. I hope that happens and that transpires to change.
I hope so as well. And I feel like sometimes by putting things out into the ether, the chances of it, having a positive outcome are sometimes higher than us not speaking, right? So that's why I love this platform and being able to kind of share the voices, right? I do have a question of when it comes to being an author and a woman. Were there any challenges?
Of course, there were challenges. Life never just goes along with a nice, smooth line, right? You get all the mountains and valleys. I think what really shocked me is when you get a retired top oil executive who is the head of a women's group who just blocks the book at every possible stage on the basis that I'm being unfair to oil and gas. This is nothing about oil and gas. This is about lack of political will and lack of due diligence by people in government.
Absolutely, absolutely. And okay, let's say I could snap my fingers. Like, what changes would you like to be made as of like yesterday almost? Do you know what I mean? Like, what changes would
Well,
you like?
I had really high hopes when Prime Minister Carney was elected, and I don't want to take away from the main issue he's dealing with, which is south of the border. But when you look at home, he is my biggest disappointment because he came across as if he was an environmentalist, as if he cared about people. And I'll go back one step before Prime Minister Carney. Justin Trudeau was Prime Minister. And at the time that he announced he was going to fix all the boiled water advisories
Right.
in the First Nation communities, the same time he founded the Canada Water Agency. Now, it was only through freedom of information requests that I found in the founding documents of the Canada Water Agency that it was based on the premise that they were not to research or attempt to deal at all with the water issues in First Nations. And they claimed it was because it was a pre-existing issue. And Prime Minister Carney has continued that by absolutely refusing to look at protecting source waters. And his announcement was through the Indigenous minister, as if the source waters only contaminate Indigenous people. Source waters contaminate every
Oh, wow.
Canadian and every visitor to Canada. It was the
Absolutely.
most ignorant statement he could have made, and a huge disappointment.
Absolutely. And what would you say as like Canadians who are, or let's say, they're just hearing this for the first time, right? Like, let's just say that they are just learning about, the fact that remote and Indigenous First Nations communities have had horrible drinking water conditions, suffered through water insecurity. What could we do?
The best thing we can do is talk about it because it doesn't matter what is in the closet. We're better off getting it out of the closet and talking about it, and in a respectful manner, but having discussions and opening our eyes and minds to the fact that maybe this isn't the glorious country that we think it would be, or that we hope or want it to be. And a lot of people have a hard time with that because, with all the issues going on in the world, I think their feeling is, oh, please, please don't tell me anything that disrupts my little world.
Absolutely.
And they're more concerned about whether their dividends from oil should fall a little bit and affect their quality of life than they are about the fact that the legacy of the unsafe drinking water is leaving huge rises in cancers for our future generations, predominantly for children and for those under 20 or 30 years old. That's a terrible legacy for us to leave behind.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so we're going to be talking about it, and I would encourage people to read about it. So how could we find your book?
They're both available: Water Confidential, Witnessing Justice Denied, and Water Justice, What You Don't Know Could Kill You, are both available from any bookstore, any library in Canada, and Amazon for those who order from Amazon. Water Justice is available as an ebook as well as a paperback. And they're also available throughout Europe, USA, every country via Amazon.
Love that. And before I let you go, is there anything that we might not have touched on that you want to share at this time?
Yeah, I'd like to share a couple of things with listeners, if you don't mind.
Yeah, please.
First of all, the example I will give is one is pesticides. And so, if you look at a country like the Netherlands, back in February of this year, they banned the sale or the purchase of farm-raised eggs. This is from free-range chickens that run around. So the Dutch people are now only allowed to buy their eggs from mass producers, 50,000 birds in cages.
Wow.
That is because they studied and researched the eggs and found that the eggs were all contaminated with PFAS. And that is because the chickens, not the eggs, but the chickens are running around eating the earthworms, and the earthworms have taken up the PFAS. Now, PFAS are not even on the radar in Canada. They're certainly not looking into whether they're in anybody's eggs. And to take it a step forward, just this month in the Netherlands, they have now made it law where to test for drinking water that has been distributed through asbestos cement pipes, which have degraded and crumbled. And so here in Canada, not only do we not have any laws governing the abandonment of asbestos cement pipes or the delivery of water, it's an atrocious situation. But here we have Holland saying specifically where the water needs to be tested. Meanwhile, in provinces in Canada, we have 14,000 kilometers of asbestos cement water pipes. We don't know how many sewage pipes we have. The sewage pipes are broken and are leaking. And so they're leaking raw sewage and asbestos fibers into the ground around them. And there are no laws whatsoever. Nobody is looking into it. And the local municipal governments are taking the easy way out and just abandoning them in place. Now, in Europe or the UK or any other developed country, they have what's called the cocktail effect, that if there are more than it used to be 13, I think they have just dropped it to either 8 or 10. I'm not quite sure of that number. But if they have more than that in any drinking water, it's deemed unsafe. So Canada has a phenomenal research scientist who just did a project where he found more than 50 pesticides in the tap water, some of them in higher concentrations than in the source water. And this was not in a little small rural community. This was in the heart of Montreal. So think about the implications. These all cause cancer. And we're looking at why are cancers increasing, but we're not really looking. the citizens, concerned people are looking, but the government's not looking. They don't want to look.
Right. So when we do, everything is always political. When we do get out there to vote, it is important that all Canadians, because we're all facing a lot of insecurity, right? I mean, I feel like I need to bring you back another time to talk about AI data centers, but I mean, that is just, an indicator that it is affecting us all, really. So
Absolutely. The National Council of Women have an open letter to Prime Minister Carney. If you go to NCWC open letter, I invite people to sign that letter because we're asking them to protect our water and protect our health. The more people that get involved and support these projects, the greater the difference, the sooner we can make a difference.
absolutely. Thank you so much, Susan Blackland. I'm actually going to include that link in our show notes. But the other link that I want to include is how we can connect with you. Let's say somebody, is listening to you now. They've heard you for the first time. Are you online? Do you have online presence?
Yes, my Facebook page is just, sorry, my website page is just susanblackland.com. You can see all the places to buy my book. You can also contact me, and I'm more than happy to do Zooms with anybody, any group, any organization, anytime to help facilitate them to answer questions and so forth.
I love it. Susan, thank you so much for your time. It's been such an informative conversation. And as a Canadian, I think it just reminds us to open our eyes, you know what I mean? And put the pressure where it needs to be put, because clean drinking water is a necessity.
That's right. Stop taking it for granted.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Susan.
Thank you very much for having me, Nicole. Much appreciated.
If you're a regular listener of this show or other shows on CJSF, we'd love to hear from you. Tell us about what you like and why you like it, as well as ways we can improve our programming. To leave comments, please email cjsfprog@sfu.ca or call 778-782-4423. This information can also be found on our website at www.cjsf.ca.
Hello, 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 and welcome back to Intravenous. Before the break, we heard from author Susan Blackland, who talked about the need for federal, provincial, and municipal regulations to protect not only drinking water, but also source water or water sources, especially in First Nations and remote communities. Next up is an interview that I recorded earlier this week with Ballet Vancouver's artistic director, Joshua Beamish.
This is Nicole with CJSF 90.1 FM, and I'd like to welcome back Ballet Vancouver's artistic director, Joshua Beamish, to CJSF. Thank you so much for joining me again. How are you, Joshua?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me back. It's great to see you again. It's obviously very busy because the show is coming up soon, but yeah, things are going really well.
Absolutely. And speaking of the show, let's segue right into it. I'm really excited. Can we so basically, Ballet Vancouver's debut season opener is going to be Balanchine's Hollow and Other Works that's coming to the Vancouver Playhouse on September 11th and 12th. You do have a full season ahead, which is super, super exciting. Can you share with listeners what they can expect when attending this mixed performance program?
Yeah, so we're opening the season with Balanchine's Apollo and Other Works, which is actually the beginning of our inaugural season. So this is our very first full season. And Balanchine's Apollo was one of his first choreographies. Balanchine is kind of widely regarded as the father of neoclassical ballet. And there is a sense of narrative within Apollo because it relates to the Greek mythology. However, he stripped away tutus and literal storytelling, I would say. It's more that the story sort of washes over the ballet. It's incredibly musical. The score is by Stravinsky. It was composed for the ballet. It's incredible. And Yeah. And this work has not been seen in Vancouver in 38 years. And it's about to have its 100th birthday in 2028. So it's,
Wow. This
yeah.
is exciting.
Yeah. And Vancouver has not seen work by Balanchine in over a decade. Miami City Ballet was here about 11 years ago, I believe. And that was the last time that we had Balanchine's work in the city. So it's quite an honor for us to be bringing this work to our community. And then contrasting that, the next piece on the program is the Black Swan Pas de Deux from Swan Lake. So the iconic ballet, the iconic classical ballet. And then, so we move back to how audiences would more widely know ballet, which is tutus. And yeah, a pure classic. And the Black Swan is one of the most dynamic parts of that ballet. And that's from Act Two, where the kind of like evil swan is seducing the prince and tricking him into marrying her instead of the white swan. So we're just going to show that excerpt of Swan Lake. And then Act Two is a ballet called Slice to Sharp, which is by Jorma Elo. And Jorma is a Finnish choreographer who's the resident choreographer of Boston Ballet. And this work was originally made on New York City Ballet 20 years ago. On
Wow.
a, yeah, on a cast entirely of principal dancers. So every role is really fantastic. It's to Baroque music. It's very fast and complex and thrilling. Like it just really drives itself. So yeah, and we would consider this work kind of like the evolution of what neoclassical ballet became. So the whole evening is really like a journey from classical through neoclassical, and then how neoclassical continues to exist for ballet today.
Love that. And I read that there are some guest principal dancers that will be performing. Do you want to share some of the dancers and who they are, just for the listeners?
Yes, we're very excited to have Heather Ogden. She is a principal dancer of the National Ballet of Canada has been so for a very long time, but she trained here at the Richmond Academy of Dance. And so she's kind of like Vancouver's National Ballet of Canada ballerina. So it's a real homecoming for her, and she's performing Apollo with our artists. And it's also very special for her because she has a very close relationship with Suzanne Farrell, who was one of Balanchine's greatest muses. And so Balanchine has been a huge part of Heather's career through this relationship with Suzanne. So that's why it's like quite an aligned special ballet to bring her back here to perform. And then we also have two guest artists from San Francisco Ballet, Sasha Dessola and Francesco Gabriele Frolla. And Francesco Gabriele, as we call him Gabriele, he was a longtime principal dancer at the National Ballet of Canada as well, and he danced there with Heather. So there's more Canadian connections in his return as well, but he's originally from Italy, and they will be performing Black Swan.
That's exciting. Now, I'm curious, like, what are you most excited about when you think about the season opener?
Honestly, I'm really excited about the entire program. This is the first program that, I mean, we had our inaugural performance, and that was very clear to me which works we were going to showcase. But in putting together an entire season of like, how am I taking people through a journey from September to February to May? It felt really important that we launched this first season with an introduction of like, what is ballet? What has ballet kind of always been? Where are we starting from? And then the rest of the year and the rest of our programming beyond can then be in conversation with this kind of like benchmark, which is like, this is classical ballet, this is neoclassical ballet, this is what we make today. So I'm excited for people to just really see these masterworks that are performed worldwide and highly regarded. Jorma is incredible. When I saw this piece right away, I was like, we have to get this ballet because it's truly phenomenal. It's some of the most exciting choreography I've ever seen in my life, and I wish I could be dancing it in another
Same.
lifetime. I would have loved to be in it. But those days have passed. But yeah, I think audiences are going to go kind of crazy for this ballet because it's kind of jaw-droppingly virtuosic. And then also Balanchine's Apollo is just so beautiful. The music is absolutely incredible. And the choreography is so musical and at times very simple, but in the way that is like so perfectly right. It's such a perfect ex visual expression of this extraordinary music. I feel like he was changing history with Apollo. And so for us to be able to see things that we think are innovative now that he was doing 100 years ago already is like, it's a good reminder, I think.
Absolutely, and especially after all these years, like you said, 38 years or something like that. So that's like pretty incredible for the Vancouver community and surrounding, right? To be able to take this in. So let's get into the details, guys. How can we connect with Ballet Vancouver and also to purchase tickets for this?
We make it very easy for you. Balletvancouver.com is how you can get your tickets. Everything is right there on the main homepage. That's also how you can connect with us, or you can follow us on Instagram at Ballet Vancouver. So you just have to remember those two words and you're good.
Absolutely. And before I let you go, because I am going to include a link to balletvancouver.com in the show notes so that it makes it super easy for people to connect. But is there anything that we might have missed that you want to share before I let you go?
One thing that's exciting for audiences is that we have pre-show talks that are included in people's tickets. So the show begins at 7:30 on both September 11th and September 12th. And those are for the evening shows. And the pre-show talk is at 6:45, both of those days, at 6:45 to 7:15. So if you come a little bit early, we're going to have a pre-show talk. The opening night is with Yorma and his wife Nancy, who was a star dancer in her own right, for and they'll speak about their ballet. But we're having Apollo staged by Peter Boll, who's the artistic director of Pacific Northwest Ballet in Seattle, and he was also a big star of New York City Ballet. So we're really the legacy of Balanchine is very strong through the way that we're learning the work. And so audiences will get to hear from Peter and Yorma and Nancy. And then on the Saturday evening pre-show talk, it's actually going to be a talk with myself and Ainsley Siopic. And Ainsley was the local dancer who performed the leading role 38 years ago here.
Oh, wow. That's
So,
awesome. That is
So we're really excited to hear her story of dancing that ballet and then 38 years later seeing it return to Vancouver on another generation of dancers.
That's
So
so
that's
awesome.
exciting. And then the other thing that's new for this program and only this program is that we have a matinee. So we have a 2 p.m. performance on the Saturday, which is unusual for our season, but we're doing it for this opener. And that pre-show talk is at 1:15 p.m.
Okay, awesome. And then I will include that information in the show notes just so that it's an easy snapshot for people. But again, I want to thank you so much for joining me again on CGSF. Please come back. I always love talking about what you have going on. And I think that the listeners appreciate it as well. So thank you.
Yes, well, thank you for your time and for having me back.
Absolutely. And everyone, Balanchine's Apollo and Other Works will be at the Vancouver Playhouse on Friday, September 11th, as well as September 12th, both with evening shows. But the 12th, there's also going to be a matinee. So that's really exciting. And I will include the link for tickets and extra info. Thank you again.
And this is Nicole, your host, and I am back. That was my conversation with Joshua Beamish and with the Ballet Vancouver. As I mentioned in our clip, Balanchine's Apollo and Other Works will be at Vancouver Playhouse on Friday, September 11th and 12th. I will include the link to balletvancouver.com in the show notes so that you can easily get tickets. Now, just like that, we are officially at the end of the show. Up next is Democracy Now. But here's one more song just to play us out. This is Wendy Eisenberg with Take a Number.